Hey everyone, and welcome to Home in Progress, brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. I'm Dan Hansen, and this is the podcast where we talk about homes, the people who shape them, and the projects that make them better, eventually. You know, whether you're deep in a remodel, maybe you're halfway through a fix-it job, or, you know, who knows what. Maybe you're just looking for a little inspiration. Wherever you're at, in the grand scheme of things, you're in the right place. And right off the bat, I apologize. I was out of coffee today, and out of the normal coffee that I make. And so I grabbed a bag of coffee that my son, my eldest son, had purchased, and I made that up, and I drank that down. And now my head is pounding, and I looked on the bag to figure out what is going on. This is strange. There is so much energy coursing through my veins. It's like I'm seeing the entire universe playing out in front of me, and I feel like I can interact with all parts of it. I feel all powerful, and that's not normal. I don't normally feel that when I drink coffee, so I looked to see what did I drink, and it's apparently coffee that has 4, 5, 6, I can't remember, 7 times the amount of caffeine of a normal cup of coffee. So, I know I already talk like a crazy person. I can only imagine what's in store for you. I am trying desperately to rein my horses in. You know, my horses are running. My horses are going crazy. I'm trying to rein them in and slow my mouth down. But I do apologize in advance if I am unable to control those wild beasts. Anyway, Home in Progress. That's what you're listening to. I talked about it last week. I'll mention it briefly again. I've changed the name of the show. It's going to be same old content as the Repco Light Home Improvement Show, so no improvements there. Same old thing, just a different wrapper, a different package. All right, Home in Progress. On the show this week, I want to do what I've done for the past few years, and I want to take a deep dive into 4th of July related topics. You know, there are some home improvement takeaways in all of this, but really, these are just fun. I had a lot of fun with the topics today. Now, I've got 2 of them picked, and coming up in a little bit, we're going to get to one where I take a deep dive into Revolutionary War hero Paul Revere. Now, I don't know what you think you know about the man, the myth, the legend, Paul Revere, but I can pretty much promise you that I'm going to surprise you with at least a few things. It's a lot of fun. That's coming up in a bit. But right now, if I asked you to picture a colonial era home, say something from the 1700s, what do you see? What do you imagine? A plain white clapboard house, maybe black shutters, maybe a weathered red barn sitting somewhere nearby. What about the interiors? You know, do you picture calm, muted, conservative color schemes? Well, that's the image that a lot of us carry, but it's not the full story. Colonial America was more colorful than we usually give it credit for. In fact, the colors people used were sometimes far bolder and far more vivid than we'd expect. And it's not just theory. In recent years, preservation experts from the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, which is the organization behind the Living History Site in Virginia, they've been using microscopes, they've been using chemical analysis and all of those things to examine old paint layers. And what they found under the centuries of fading and layered paint is really surprising. They're finding bright blues, deep greens, rich ochres, even emerald tones. And these findings are reshaping all of our assumptions about colonial interiors. You know, we've talked about this on the show before, probably, I think it was a couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago or more. We talked about the bright chrome yellow that Thomas Jefferson used to paint the dining room at Monticello. It was loud, it was bold, and it definitely wasn't the Wedgwood blue color that previously we had thought he painted that room. It was really, really interesting stuff. But that kind of vibrancy wasn't available to just anybody. You know, the colors that we see now in high-end restorations came from pigments that were either imported or really, really costly to produce. Prussian blue, for example, a popular color amongst the wealthy, but it had to come from Europe. Verdigris, you know, a green, was made by suspending copper over vinegar, which was incredibly time-consuming and expensive, you know, just a lengthy process to get to that color. Wealthier homeowners, they could afford those materials, and they could afford the labor and the time that it took to apply multiple coats on their walls. So they got the rich green parlors, the deep blue hallways, you know, the yellow dining rooms, all of that. But if you were an average tradesman or farmer, you know, you're an average Joe, you know, you're cutting the mustard, but that's about all you're cutting. You know, if that's you, your options were way more limited and a lot more local. You know, paint wasn't cheap. even the basics like linseed oil, that came at a cost. So in many rural homes, especially early on, the walls were left unpainted. Or if they were coated, it was often with something really simple, you know, homemade mixtures using whatever they had on hand. You know, iron oxide, for example, they got red from that. And it's basically rust. They gathered rust and put it in linseed oil, and there you go. You've got red paint. Yellow ochre or raw umber, they used those materials for warm, earthy yellows and browns. Carbon black came from charred wood. Lime whitewash, it was simple, really cheap to make, widely used, but it really required a lot of maintenance. It wasn't durable at all. Now, these colors that they had weren't selected for style. You know, they weren't finding just the right carbon black, just the right iron red oxide. They were chosen because they were there. And somebody was saying, you got to use something, use that mud over there. It's going to make a nice brown for you. So they were warm, they're practical, they were muted. And in many cases, the goal wasn't to decorate something, it was to protect something. These coatings sealed wood and helped preserve structures from the weather. And the fact that they added color was more or less incidental, you know, not a big part of the process. When it comes to process, let's talk about making the paint a minute, just briefly. How did they do that? How did they, you know, get all of that stuff together? Well, they did it right at home. There were no Repco lights making paint for them, no fan decks to choose from. If you wanted to add color to your world, basically you had to go dig something up in the yard, grind the pigments yourself, and then you're stirring it into oil. I mentioned linseed oil earlier. You're stirring it into that, into milk, into lime. It's a messy, labor-intensive process. And as an aside, it was crazy unpredictable. You know, one batch might go on smooth and dry evenly and be this or that color. The next batch that you make using what you thought were the same ingredients might function differently, might have an entirely different color. You know, who knew? You didn't know. It was a crapshoot. Still, for those who could afford it, color was more than a coating. It was a message, right? So that bright white house that we might picture, it wasn't about simplicity. You know, we tend to sometimes think, oh, they went white because they're, you know, being modest or being simplistic or something like that, you know, just streamlined. No, if you had a white house, especially an immaculate white house, it meant you had the means to reapply that whitewash regularly. Like I said, it didn't last. It wasn't a durable product, so it had to be reapplied regularly. If you could do that and keep the house looking good, you had some money. That was what that said. If you had a rich yellow or a blue somewhere, that meant imported pigments had to come in. It meant skilled labor was involved. Again, it meant you had money. In colonial America, color wasn't just aesthetic. It wasn't just about setting the mood or the tone for a room. That happened. That was part of it. But it was also a way of telling your neighbors what kind of cash, what kind of resources you had access to, what you valued, where you stood, you know, in the economic scheme of things. But even the most expensive, eye-popping colors didn't stay that way. Over time, they changed. Verdigris, for example, it darkened when exposed to sunlight. Prussian blue often faded towards gray or green. Linseed oil yellowed as it aged. Go ahead and add decades of weather and wear, and many of those original colors became nearly unrecognizable. So part of the reason that we now imagine colonial homes as drab or colorless is because we're not seeing what was originally there. We're seeing what's left behind, you know, after centuries of change, but not what was originally there. And so when these restoration projects took off in the early 1900s, many of them leaned into restraint. Soft whites, sage greens, grays, things like that. The choices felt historic, but it turns out they weren't always accurate. Now that we've got better tools and a little scientific detective work that we can do, we're beginning to set the record straight. Paint analysis and pigment research from institutions like Colonial Williamsburg, we mentioned them earlier, they've helped us reconstruct historically accurate palettes, sometimes down to the exact mix of ingredients. Benjamin Moore even partnered with Colonial Williamsburg to create a color collection based on these findings. Their Williamsburg palette includes soft creams, smoky greens, rich browns, saturated blues, all colors pulled from original paint chips, from plaster fragments, from wallpaper samples. They're not just guesses, they're evidence-based recreations of what 18th century America really looked like. And I love that. That is so interesting to me because paint, you know, something we so often think about as a background, is actually a bit of a time machine. It tells us who we were, what we had, you know, and what we thought mattered. It reminds us that even the simplest design choice, what color to put on the walls, it really, at the grand scheme of things, that is a pretty simple choice compared to all the other things that go into decor and designing a home. Even that simple choice, though, was loaded with meaning. So yeah, some colonial colors, they were quite colorful. Some were even stunning, you know, incredibly vivid. Other areas, other homes were completely uncoated. Or if they were coated, they were coated with whatever a family could make by hand. But each one of those colors, everything that went on anywhere, tells a story. And now, thanks to science, we're starting to see these stories a little more clearly. It's really interesting. Definitely something to dig into a little further. And by all means, go back in time. I'll put a link in the show notes. But go back in time and find our discussion on Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. We dig into a little more of the science behind discovering that color. It's really, really interesting. Go check that out. All right, that's enough of that. Now I want to talk about Paul Revere. The man, the myth, the legend. There is so much more going on with Paul Revere than you probably know. And we're going to get to that after this. You're listening to Home in Progress. Real projects, real life, and a little bit of paint on your hands, in your eyes, in your hair, on your shirt, everywhere. Home in Progress is sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore, offering expert advice, premium paint, and all the tools you need to keep your home moving forward. And we're back. You're listening to Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And we're working our way through another 4th of July extravaganza. I love the 4th of July. I get so giddy that my voice breaks. That's what happened earlier. It's not that I'm, you know, still growing into a real boy. It's because I'm just that excited. Anyway, I love the 4th of July. I think because of its close connection to the American Revolution. You know, I'm not a big fireworks fan or all of those things. I like grilling hot dogs. I like having a day off. But I think the biggest reason I'm drawn to the 4th of July is just, you know, the connection that it has to the American Revolution. Ever since I was a little kid, little Danny always loved reading about George Washington, Valley Forge, Ben Franklin, and all of those people. It's an amazing period in our history. And there's just something about how all of these people, you know, were in the right place at the right time. It's amazing. And yes, I'm well aware that they were all flawed individuals in one way or another. You know, they weren't perfect. They made mistakes like the rest of us make. But still, there's still something really interesting in the fact that they were all there at the right time, you know, all there together. I read something interesting the other day. The average written constitution around the world lasts about 17 to 19 years before it has to be replaced or significantly revised. By that standard, the U.S. Constitution is practically ancient since it's been in place since 1789, making it not only one of the oldest written national constitutions still in use, but probably the most influential, you know, especially considering that it's governing such a large, diverse, and ever-evolving country and has done so for over two centuries. Now, realizing that the people needed to craft that document all happened to be in the same place around the same time is pretty amazing. It's a great, great human story. I love it. And right now, I want to look at one of these characters from the Revolutionary War, not so much from drafting the Constitution, but just from the Revolutionary War period. I want to look at one of these guys, Paul Revere. Now, when you hear the name Paul Revere, I'm betting that you're thinking of a guy on a horse riding through the Massachusetts countryside, hollering, "The British are coming! The British are coming!" And then he's getting, you know, shushed, shh, by ladies with their babies or old men who, you know, just got up to go to the bathroom and they're trying to get back to sleep and they don't want to hear this stuff. But Paul Revere is just riding through. That's probably the image in your mind. You know, that's one of those images that's burned into our minds from an early age. And whether we know it or not, it's largely there because of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, Paul Revere's Ride. Now, that poem, it's not an incredibly, or at least it's not an entirely, I should say, accurate, historically accurate poem or representation of the events, but still, it painted quite a picture, and it really embedded itself in the national psyche. So that's how we know Paul Revere. But Paul Revere's importance in the grand scheme of the country is way more than that one midnight ride, and I'm going to get to that. But let's start at the beginning. And for Paul Revere, like most people, the beginning means we got to start with his birth. And right off the bat, the guy's interesting. You know, he's not going to be born just like everybody else because he's Paul Revere, dang it. And he's born in two different years. All right. Same guy. Singular person born in two different years, not twins, same guy, two different years. He's born in both 1734 and 1735. Are you working that one out? Are you thinking it through? Do you think you have the answer? He was born in those 2 years, 11 days apart. All right. So it's not midnight on December 31 that he starts to be born and then happens to be born the rest of the way, completes the deal. On the new year. No, 11 days apart. How in the world did that happen? It's a fun little trivia fact. You can break this out at your 4th of July event and festivities later today. Here's the deal. Paul was originally born on December 21, 1734. All right? Fully born. There he is. Boom. Paul Revere in the world. December 21, 1734, according to the old Julian calendar that was being used in the British colonies at the time. But when Britain adopted the Gregorian calendar in September of 1752, the calendar shifted forward by 11 days, and all of a sudden Paul's official date of birth went from December 21, 1734, to January 1, 1735. All right. So we have a man with two birthdays, but that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Paul Revere. So he was born on January 1, 1735. We'll use that date to Apollos Revere. His original name was Revoir. It was French. He was born to Apollos Revoir and his wife, Deborah. Now, Apollos had moved to Boston from France in 1716, and around 1722, he changed that name to Revere, probably because his wife-to-be's family, you know, they were native Bostonians. I bet they couldn't pronounce Revoir, and they probably said it with some ridiculous fake French accent like you hear in the cartoons. Revoir. I bet that's what they said. He was sick and tired of listening to it, and so he said, look, changing the name. It's not going to be Revoir anymore. It's just going to be Revere. So you guys can say that. Say Revere. Anyway, Apollos changed his last name to Revere. That is not important to this part of the story, but I was really hung up on that. So I wanted to drill into that in a lot more detail than was necessary. He changed his name to Revere, married Deborah, and then set up a silver shop on Boston's North End. And it was there in that silversmith shop that young Paul, a wee lad, you know, just a wee whippersnapper, he began learning the silversmithing craft, working side by side with his pappy. And by his teens, Paul was assisting with all kinds of things, tasks like polishing finished pieces. He was shaping simple forms. He was handling basic soldering work. You know, he likely spent hours and hours and hours melting scrap silver, hammering out sheets, and learning how to engrave decorative patterns into tankards and teapots. You know, he was even producing small engraved items on his own. You know, things like nameplates, rings, perhaps custom buttons or charms. He was repairing belt buckles, you know, the little buckles on their shoes even. You know, because remember, they had buckles on their shoes back then. We've even got historical records, including Revere's own account books, preserved by the Massachusetts Historical Society, showing that he took on tons of small jobs as a teenager. Probably so he had money for taking girls out on dates. Or maybe getting, you know, the latest music or whatever he was into at that time. Anyway, when his father died in 1754, 19-year-old Paul, his birthday has just been switched, by the way. So he's still dealing with the fact that he's no longer a December 21 baby, but now he's a January 1 baby. I'm sure that really played in his psyche. Probably not as important as when his father passed away. But when his dad dies, 19-year-old Paul takes over the family business. A few years later, he marries Sarah Orne, and they begin raising a family. Now, as a quick aside, Paul had 8 children with Sarah, and she died giving birth to their 8th child, and the 8th child also passed away. After that, after a while passed, he married Rachel Walker, his second wife, and proceeded to have 8 more kids. So, yeah, 15 kids. Paul was busy. He had a lot going on. Now, when we look at the pieces, let's get back to the important stuff. Let's look at the stuff that he's making. So when we look at the pieces, you know, the silver that he's producing in this period, the cream pitchers, the tankards, the sugar bowls, you know, all of those things, probably cool little salt shakers, little salt and pepper shakers sets. I'm sure he was doing all of that stuff. He probably made the cream pitchers that look like a cow that you grab the tail and you pour it and the milk comes out of its mouth, which doesn't make any sense at all. Right, anatomically, that's not where the milk should come from. But anyway, I don't know that Paul made those. Don't take me to the bank on that. But when we look at the stuff that we know he did make, the cream pitchers, the tankards, the sugar bowls, we see that his skills are developing, right? We see that they're coming along, but he's still coloring inside the lines. You know, he's not really breaking new ground. He's duplicating what's popular, and he's doing the things the same way that his dad did them. But in 1768, that starts to change. And we're going to explain what happens that brings that change about right after this. Stick around. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Top tier paint, expert advice. Your next project is way easier than you think it's going to be. So what is this big change that I'm talking about? How do we see it evidenced? Well, we see it evidenced in an item that he creates. Probably one of the most famous pieces that he creates, the Liberty Bowl. Now, by this point in his career, he's been running his own shop for about 14 years or so. So his confidence is growing, his skill is deepening, but it's not just Paul Revere who's changing. That's important, you know, as we look at his whole life. It's not just him who's experiencing these changes. The whole colony is changing. All of the colonies are changing. You know, public sentiment is shifting. People are growing restless. Tensions with the British are heating up. And Paul Revere himself is becoming more and more committed to the revolutionary cause. Now, out of that moment comes the Liberty Bowl. Now, at first glance, it's just a punch bowl. You know, 11 inches across, raised from a single sheet of silver. It's hand engraved. But it's way more than just that. It's also a political statement. Now, the engravings on the bowl, they honor the 92 members of the Massachusetts Assembly who had defied the crown. So it's clearly political in that regard, but there's way more cool stuff to this story. See, it was designed not just to sit on a shelf like a fancy, you know, like a fancy participation trophy. It was commissioned and designed to be passed around at gatherings of the Sons of Liberty. You know those guys, right? Boston Tea Party guys, the Sons of Liberty. It's passed around at their gatherings, filled with punch, and then it's emptied in acts of noisy public defiance. You know, I can picture it. Sam Adams, John Hancock, Patrick Henry, you know, the Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death guy, all of them gathered in some back room, you know, hollering, passing the bowl, plotting their next move. Now, for us today, a punch bowl probably brings to mind, you know, grandma's house, you know, fancy parties at grandma's house, church potlucks, things like that. But in the 1760s and the 1770s, punch was political. And it was a communal drink, usually alcoholic, and it was served at taverns and private meetings, places where people would meet to talk, argue, organize, things like that. And as the revolution is gaining steam, those gatherings, of course, became hotbeds of resistance. So when the Sons of Liberty pass around a punch bowl like Paul Revere's Liberty Bowl, it wasn't just for refreshment. They weren't looking for a little dab of sherbet on a hot day. It was a ritual, you know, sherbet in punch. That's a common recipe that we have for making punch when I was a kid. They weren't looking for sherbet. They were experiencing a moment of unity. You know, you weren't just sipping a drink here. You were toasting the rebellion. You were thumbing your nose at the crown, you know. Take that, Your Majesty. How do you feel about it now? We're drinking from the Liberty Bowl here. You were raising a glass in protest. So yeah, it was a punch bowl, but it was also a symbol, you know, a shared act of resistance. And in that way, Paul Revere's Liberty Bowl was more than just a beautiful piece of silver. It was a tool of the revolution. And the message didn't stop with the engraving and the symbolic act of drinking the punch. Even the design of the Liberty Bowl itself was rebellious. It was clean, neoclassical. It was stripped of, you know, the over-the-top flourishes that defined the British aristocracy. It was elegant, but it was restrained. It was practical, not pretentious. You know, that wasn't an accident. It was a deliberate break from the "we're better than you" aesthetic of the crown. Everything about the Liberty Bowl, from how it looked to how it was used, sent a message. It was a showcase of skill and craftsmanship, sure, but it was also the work of an artist who had something to say, which was a big shift from the work that he was previously producing. And on top of all of that, Paul Revere wasn't done adding new skills to his repertoire. That same year, 1768, he adds dentist to his growing resume. Dentist. On top of everything else, he's got time to become a dentist. He published an ad in the Boston Gazette thanking past clients and going on to announce that he's available to craft artificial teeth. You know, thanks for buying your paint from us. We just started doing dental work. That's the equivalent. You know, if Repcolite would run that ad, that's what Paul's doing. Thanks for letting me make your silver. Have you ever thought about having me make your teeth? Well, that's the ad that goes out. Now, he's not making full dentures like we would think of today, but he's making partials, and he's making them from ivory, animal tusk, metal, things like that. You know, he saw a need, realized that he had the tools and the skills, and then he stepped into the gap. Some might even say the gap between people's teeth. He stepped right into that gap. That is so dumb. But he did. That's literally what he did. And because of that, because he stepped into the gap in various people's teeth, he stepped into the gap with a replacement partial. Because he did that, Paul Revere became a big part of history in yet another way, another unexpected way. And I bet you don't know this. Most of you won't know this. After the Battle of Bunker Hill in 1775, Dr. Joseph Warren, a fellow patriot, he was killed in that battle and he was buried in a mass grave. Months later, Paul Revere helps identify his body because he's able to recognize a dental prosthesis that he had personally made for the good doctor. That moment of recognition is widely regarded as the first known use of forensic dentistry in America, and it goes back to Paul Revere. So take that to your next little family event and whip that little fact out. You're going to have to work at it to get to the point where that isn't just coming out of the blue at people, but you can do it, and it's a good one. It's a good little tidbit that you can take with you. So yeah, Paul Revere, he's an accomplished silversmith. He's a dabbling dentist, but that's not all. He also becomes one of the most prolific engravers of his era. He produces certificates, illustrations, political cartoons, book plates, all of them meticulously etched into copper plates. His most famous work of this, you know, of this type of work is the engraving of the Boston Massacre. And that was dramatic and emotionally charged. You know, the piece that he made, incredibly emotionally charged. It wasn't entirely accurate. You know, historically, it wasn't meant to be. It was propaganda, and it worked. It really stirred up the anger. It helped unify the colonies against the British occupation. So Paul Revere, he's all of the things that I talked about, the craftsman, the dentist, you know, the engraver, the illustrator, all of these things. But primarily, he's a patriot, deeply, deeply involved in the revolutionary movement. And that's going to bring us to the events that most of us remember, the Midnight Ride. You know, the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. Now, on the night of April 1875, Paul Revere receives word that the British troops are on the move. They're likely heading to arrest Samuel Adams and John Hancock in Lexington. They're going to seize weapons that are stored in Concord. Well, Paul springs into action. Now, first, he's arranged for two lanterns to be hung in the steeple of the Old North Church. And that's a signal, as we all know, for patriots across the river in Charleston. And it's letting them know, hey, the British are coming by sea. Then he's rowed across the Charles River and he mounts a borrowed horse. I got a feeling that what happened is they rowed him across the river and they put him on a little bit of a hill or something. And then they pulled a horse just beneath him, because that's always how it is in the movies with cowboys. And then he jumped from that little cliff or that little hill and landed firmly on the seat or the saddle. The saddle of the horse and took off across the countryside. So he's riding around through Massachusetts and he's warning everybody, the militia leaders and everything. He's rousing the local population. Now, he didn't yell, sadly, the British are coming. I guess, how do we know? We don't know for sure. I would like to believe that he yelled, the British are coming. But apparently, we don't have that definitively. In fact, it seems like we could probably imply that he might not have yelled that at all. But he did knock on doors, he did raise the alarm, and he triggered a communication chain that mobilized the militia. And he wasn't riding alone. Paul Revere was part of a well-organized intelligence network, you know, a relay system of riders and informants. William Dawes took a different route. Others joined along the way. And yeah, Paul Revere was eventually detained by a British patrol, and he didn't even make it all the way to Concord. But by the time that happened, the warning had already been spread. You know, it was fast, it was efficient, did a good job, it worked. And thanks to those efforts, the colonial militias were ready. And the next morning, the battles of Lexington and Concord marked the official start of the American Revolution. Now, after Lexington and Concord, as the war is intensifying, Paul Revere steps into a completely new role, wartime manufacturing. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress tasks him with inspecting a newly created gunpowder mill in Canton. And there's a problem with this. You know, Paul Revere has no background in chemistry or explosives or anything like that. But instead of passing the job off, he travels to a working mill in Philadelphia. He observes the process there, takes copious notes, notepad after notepad he's filling out, and then he returns to help oversee and improve the Massachusetts production. Now, that same year, he took on a government contract to cast cannons. You know, another thing he had absolutely no prior experience doing. Surprise, surprise, the first cannons that he made failed. They were losers. They were lemons. You know, absolute lemons. They cracked. They were unusable. Send these cannons back to Paul Revere. These are no good. But he didn't walk away dejected and horrified that he'd made cruddy cannons. He studied. He adjusted his techniques. He refined his methods until the cannons that he was producing passed inspection and actually saw service. Now, as the war progressed, he served as a major in the Massachusetts militia and then later was promoted to lieutenant colonel of a newly formed artillery regiment. Now, he wasn't a trained soldier, but he was creative. He was determined. He was capable of organizing and leading others. And for the most part, as he did all of that, things went well. But there's a big but coming up. Not everything went smoothly. In 1779, it was a really rough year for Paul. In fact, probably one of Paul's worst years. If he had a diary, it probably said, "Dear Diary, 1779 stunk." What happened? We're going to get to that story right after this. This is Home in Progress, where the to-do list is long, and that's all right. We're not crabbing at you. We're not going to yell at you. That's how it is. It's how ours is, too. It's proudly supported by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore, because home projects are easier when you've got people you can trust. All right, so 1779. What in the world made this year so bad for Paul Revere? Well, to get to that, we've got to look at the Penobscot Expedition. The Penobscot Expedition. I am sure I'm not saying that smoothly. It's not an easy word to say. P-E-N-O-B-S-C-O-T. Penobscot. During that expedition, which was a military campaign that was designed to be quick, you know, decisive, and of course victorious. Not many campaigns, military campaigns, are designed to be failures. This one was designed to be victorious, and they were going to drive the British out of eastern Maine, reclaim the territory, and secure the coast. You know, great big grand vision here. On paper, it looked like it was brilliant. You know, it was going to work. American land forces, including Paul Revere and his artillery regiment, were going to coordinate with a fleet of naval ships, and together they were going to corner the British and force a surrender. But that is not how it played out at all. Poor leadership, miscommunication, hesitation among the commanders turned the campaign into a literal catastrophe. The land troops, including Revere and his artillery, clashed repeatedly with their superiors. And while they were stalled on land, the American fleet sat vulnerable in Penobscot Bay. Now, eventually, the British reinforcements arrive, and in the chaos of that, the entire American fleet, which was over 40 ships, was destroyed. Many were scuttled or burned by their own crews to prevent capture. That was the worst naval disaster in American history until Pearl Harbor. Now, in the aftermath of all of that, Paul Revere was accused of disobedience, he was accused of cowardice, and those charges ended up leading to a military court-martial. The trial itself dragged on for 3 years, something like that, and during that time, Paul Revere was effectively sidelined. You know, his name is tarnished, his career's at an absolute standstill. But finally, when the court convenes in 1782, he's acquitted on all counts. The tribunal found no basis, absolutely no basis for the accusations. Turns out much of the blame rested on the higher-ranking officers. Sure, Paul Revere had made mistakes. We all made mistakes. It was a crazy time, but they weren't criminal mistakes. So his name is cleared, and he comes out of that ordeal determined that he's going to rebuild his life and his reputation. And that's exactly what he ends up doing. So at the age of 65, the war's over, he's 65 years old. Many people, you know, they would slow down at this point. Some of us slow down way before that. But at 65, Paul Revere jumps into industrial manufacturing. That was a bold move. You know, he was trying to bring rolled copper technology, which was then, you know, mostly a European innovation. He was trying to bring that into American hands. Now, why copper? Well, he did it because copper sheets were critical to naval shipbuilding. And as you remember, we lost a lot of ships in the Penobscot expedition. So Paul Revere is doing what he can to replenish the American fleet. And this sheathing ends up being used on the wooden hulls of ships like the USS Constitution, which, thanks in part to this copper, is still afloat today. Now, what's interesting is in this endeavor, like in so many things that he undertook, he didn't know what he was doing in the beginning. He visited European-style mills. He studied machinery. He hired experts. He experimented, sometimes with success, often with failure. He had to troubleshoot every aspect of the process, the temperature, the alloy ratios, the rolling techniques. It was a constant grind of learning and then revising and then rebuilding. But he didn't give up. You know, that's the thing that's really cool about all of this. He didn't give up. He kept pushing, he kept refining, and eventually he got it right. And his copper sheets were used, like I said, on the hulls of ships, but also on the roofs of public buildings and in countless industrial applications. The business that he started at this point in his life, you know, what would become the Revere Copper and Brass Company, helped lay the groundwork for American manufacturing. Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely crazy all the things the guy did. You know, in the end, Paul Revere wasn't just that guy on a horse shouting warnings in the night. He was a silversmith. He was a printer, a dentist. A dentist. Remember the dentist? He was a political organizer, a military officer, a cannon maker. He worked with gunpowder. He was a copper baron. You know, in every sense of the word, he was a pioneer of American industry. Now, he died in 1818 at the age of 83. He'd spent his entire life doing what makers do best. And we're going to get to that term in a little bit here. What makers do best, that's what Paul Revere did. Solving problems, learning new things, and trying again and again and again after failure, and then in the end, building something that will last. And when you look at it that way, Paul Revere's story isn't just a piece, you know, a little tiny piece of American history. It's kind of like a blueprint. You know, it's a plan. It's proof that you don't need to be perfect or prepared before you begin something. You just need to start. You need to jump in. And that mindset, that approach to life, nowadays, we would call it the maker's mentality. And it's not just about building cabinets or fixing furniture. You know, that's not just what a maker is. It's about the way you approach life. You know, it's about being curious, being willing to learn. It's being willing to mess up. You know, it's not needing to be perfect before you start something. It's saying, I don't know how to do this. In fact, I might not even have a clue, but I can figure it out. Or at least maybe I can figure it out. I'm going to try to figure it out. That's what Paul Revere did over and over and over again. That's why I spent this entire episode talking about him, most of the episode talking about him. He didn't always know what he was doing. He wasn't trained as a dentist, which is exactly the dentist we all want, right? In some instances, we want the degree, you know. So in some instances, this isn't perfect. Back then, just jump in. You know, it's a free for all. You don't mind touching people's mouths, the inside of it. Maybe dentistry is for you. Try. No, that's not what we want. We want the degree in dentistry and medical science. You know, if you're going to cut me open and remove some innards, I'd like you to at least have a degree on your wall that means something. But in a lot of other situations, you know, I'm talking around the home and stuff like that, it's okay to not know exactly what you're doing, but just to jump in anyway and learn along the way. Now, you've got to be smart. You jump in situations where you're not going to pose a threat to your family or to the safety of your home or the longevity of your home. I'm not saying figure out brakes, you know, how to put brakes on your car on the fly. You know, that's not part of the maker's mentality. You work with smaller things and build up to that. You change your windshield wipers. You change the battery in the car. You do all of that. And then you build up eventually over time as you're learning your skills and you're developing, you're gaining confidence, you're gaining insight. And eventually you tackle the bigger things. You know, when it comes to painting, you don't start, you know, the very first time you open a can of paint, you don't paint the exterior of your home. You start with smaller things, build the confidence, build the skills. The maker's mentality is a first step, a necessary first step to all of that. And it's the step that says, I don't know it now, but I'm willing to jump in and try. I'm willing to learn, and I'm willing to deal with some failure. I'm not going to be perfect, but I'm going to still plow through. I'm going to persevere, and I'm going to get there. That mindset works everywhere. It works in a workshop. It works in a kitchen. Works at a desk job. It works in parenting. It's not about being an expert. Like I said, it's about being willing to try. And when you live like that, when you lean into that maker's mindset, you really start to realize that the world isn't something that just happens to you. You know, your home isn't just something that happens to you and you've got to just deal with it as best you can by calling in experts and waiting till they can get there. When you've got a maker's mindset, you gain agency. You know, you can shape things, you control things, you can fix things. You're not waiting for somebody else necessarily. You're willing to jump in and try. You can be, let's say it this way, you can be a mini little DIY version of Paul Revere. That's the whole point of all of this. You know, and it's fun because it's 4th of July. It's fun to talk about Paul Revere and this era in general, but also to squeeze a little bit of DIY goodness out of it and maybe apply it to our lives. So get out there and give it a shot. Give it a try. And if your project does involve paint, you know, if that's part of what you're working on, we're here to help. So just swing out to any Repcolite. Tell us what you're working on. We'll get you moving in the right direction. Thank you so much for listening to Home in Progress. I hope today's story, you know, gave you a new perspective on Paul Revere. Maybe it sparked a little inspiration for your next project. If you do want to hear more stories like this, more content like this, where history and home improvement collide and all kinds of different things, it's what we do on the show. If you want to hear that, be sure to follow the show and leave us a review. That really helps new listeners find us, and it lets us keep making great content for you. You can find Home in Progress wherever you get your podcasts, and if you're enjoying the show, share it with a friend who might love it too. Have a safe and happy 4th of July weekend. Enjoy your time with your family. And remember, whatever project you've got next on your list, Repcolite is here to help you make it easier. I'm Dan Hansen. See you next time.